I'm here with Hans von Spakovsky, senior legal fellow, Heritage Foundation, one of the great experts on voting in this country. Hans, their bill does not talk about the registration of voting of citizens. It talks about individuals, which opens the door wide to illegal aliens, as do these lists, where you're not actually allowed to really fix these lists. And as people vote under this legislation, as I understand it, for instance, an election judge in a precinct really is not free to challenge somebody voting because they can be criminally charged. Moreover, as I understand it, you don't have to vote in your own precinct. You can vote in another precinct if you choose to do that. They want to register 16 and 17-year-olds who would actually be able to vote, given the fact that there's no serious ability to challenge their votes or to prevent them from voting. Is that correct?
Yeah, unfortunately, that is correct. Those are all provisions in this bill that would make it, frankly, very easy for people who aren't actually eligible to vote to actually vote and get away with it.
Felons who haven't even finished their terms, they would have the right to vote. Mail-in voting would be mandatory in every state, and the counting can take up to 10 days under this federal law, so the outcome would be delayed for 10 days.
Right.
And there's other things in here, too, but they set up a special commission, which they say is intended to promote and defend democratic institutions. And this commission has members placed on it who have the power to force judges who have ruled on this statute or ruled on voting under this statute, force them to come to Washington, D.C. and explain themselves. So you would actually have judges reporting to a commission, and you would have individuals who might raise constitutional questions about this law or issues related to elections under this law, and they could only come to one place to bring their lawsuit, a district court in Washington, D.C., and most of these claims would all be joined together. This entire thing, Hans, is set up for the Democrat Party. It undermines the franchise. And then when you watch Democrats say that this is intended to promote voting, and anyone who opposes it opposes minorities from voting? How in any way does this prevent minorities from voting? That is, objecting to a law like this that would destroy the franchise across the board. Does it have anything to do with minorities?
No, it doesn't at all. In fact, it will this bill, if passed, will disenfranchise all voters, including minority voters. I mean, look, just one quick example out of what you were just talking about. Look, it has been a tradition in America for forever that you are supposed to vote in the precinct to which you've been assigned. There's a good reason for that. First, that way officials know how many ballots should be in each precinct, because if you don't know how many people are going to show up, you may run out of ballots and people may not be able to vote. Second, it ensures that you get the ballot that allows you to vote for everybody you're entitled to vote for, not just nationally, but folks who are running for state and local offices. This bill would require states to allow people to vote outside of their assigned precinct, which means that if you go to a precinct on the other side of a large county where you live, well, yeah, you may be able to vote for president. You may be able to vote for the U.S. senators. But you won't be qualified to vote, perhaps, for a member of Congress or state legislators or members of the city council. So you are, in effect, giving voters the ability to disenfranchise themselves because they may not realize that. That's why this is just such a bad bill. I mean, it's not just many parts of it are unconstitutional. It's just bad and reckless policy.
And I do want to remind the audience that the framers of the Constitution would have vehemently opposed this. They did not believe in all the power going to Washington, D.C. If they did, they would have said so. But instead, there are two provisions, and especially Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2, that leaves it to state legislatures specifically to write election laws, including as it applies to the selection of a president and vice president of the United States. This would effectively take that provision of the Constitution, Hans, and eliminate it. And eliminated.
And look, the reason for that, Mark, as you well know, is they were afraid that if Congress could set out all the rules for federal elections, then what would they do? Well, they would put in rules and laws that would favor them as incumbents and help them retain power in Congress. And that's why I think the framers distributed the power and authority to run federal elections down between the federal government and the states. And this bill just totally overrides that.
Don't tell Vance Ginn, but $200 billion of the pandemic unemployment benefit could have been stolen by fraudsters. One expert says that's more than three times what the government is estimating. NTD's Colin Fredrickson reports.
Whenever the government hands out free money, people lie to get some. And it's happening right now.
Serious concerns about suspected fraud, including instances of accounts established with stolen identities.
Computer security firm ID.me has found that a massive amount of unemployment benefits are being pilfered.
We're talking about at least $63 billion in fraud, which is a low-end estimate, and potentially $200 billion or more. It's just this enormous level of, you know, unintentional payments that weren't supposed to go to these people that are nevertheless taxpayers' money that is being wasted.
To put it into perspective, in 2019, the U.S. spent about $28 billion in unemployment insurance benefits. Many are filing for unemployment benefits using someone else's name, and there are fewer checks on eligibility.
There are criminal enterprises that are engaged in this fraud, but it's not only those criminal enterprises, it's also fraud, or we'd say abuse and misuse of the program as well.
Maine Senator Susan Collins says California's fraud problem is especially bad. It has a 9% unemployment rate, and yet almost 14% of the labor force is filing unemployment benefits each week under the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program.
There can be no excuse for the kind of rampant fraud that has been so prevalent in California.
Collins says California has an estimated $11.4 billion in fraud. Far more than any other state. She blames the state's policies.
They're paying UI benefits before determining if the applicants are eligible.
If you believe your identity has been used to claim benefits, contact your state unemployment insurance system. Colin Fredrickson, NTD News.
Since becoming president, Joe Biden has wasted no time in provoking our rivals around the world. He upset Russian President Vladimir Putin by calling him a killer. And then additionally, Chinese officials roughed up our Secretary of State at their first face-to-face meeting last week. And then North Korea won't even pick up the phone to answer Biden's calls. So is Biden's foreign policy agenda hurting America? Joining us to discuss is Vice President of National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation, Lieutenant Colonel James Carafano. Thank you so much for joining us. Always great to have you.
Good to be with you.
So what do you make, just an overall picture of what's happening with the Biden administration when it comes to foreign policy right now?
Sure. Well, there's no question Iran, North Korea, Russia, and China, that they're all testing and probing the president. This is understandable. It often happens with new presidents. Particularly understandable here, the administration came in office. It's clear that they actually don't have a specific plan for any of these other than saying, well, we're not going to be Trump. And I think, look at what's going on in the border crisis right now. And I think they must be paying particular attention to that. That the president is distracted and apparently disengaged. They've implemented a policy which follows their ideology, their agenda, and then the facts on the ground have been disastrous, and they almost refuse to acknowledge them. And they seem more obsessive about covering up their own failures than in addressing the problems. So if you're a bad guy and you're testing the Biden administration, you add those three things up, and you say, well, this is a formula to probe to see how really these guys react in crisis. So I do think it's a bit of a cause for concern.
Do you have any feeling as what the Biden agenda in foreign policy would be? And is it clear to everyone that works below him so that they can carry it out?
I think that there's kind of three brains going on in the Biden camp, and I'm not really sure which one is going to own foreign policy. A lot of the individuals in this administration are people that served in the Obama administration, and it's very clear that their idea is, we'll just go back and did what we did before Trump got here. Then there's an incredibly radical wing of this party, which has some really, really ideas that are outside the mainstream. Like, what's the problem with Iran and just turn the Middle East over to the Muslim Brotherhood? We don't see a problem with that. And, you know, China's ideology, we actually kind of like China's ideology. So, and then there's the president himself, who has a kind of a record of wanting to sit down and kind of be very deliberative and kind of think these things through, and is actually fairly risk averse. And it's not clear to me who's going to win that battle. What is clear to me is, on all the big issues, North Korea, Russia, China, Iran, global terrorism, they came into office without a plan.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what it looks like.
They also seem to have, or some have argued, the opposite stance when it comes to pulling our troops out of what they call forever wars. What did you make of the Secretary of Defense's surprise trip to Afghanistan?
Well, I've always believed that a stable Afghanistan is important. The United States makes South Asia stable. That's important. We need India to be stable, so they help out with China. So I've always thought that the conditions, our troop levels and our actions in Afghanistan have to be driven by conditions at the ground. But writ largely, what's really, really interesting, and nobody's really talked about this at all, is if you look closely, where the Biden administration has basically followed closely to Trump's foreign policy, even if they didn't call it Trump's foreign policy, they're kind of doing okay. In the areas where they have most radically departed from that, like border and immigration and the Middle East, that's where they've had the most trouble.
Interesting. Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that wraps it up. Thank you so much for joining us, Lieutenant Colonel James Carafano. We appreciate it.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for watching the Heritage Foundation's YouTube channel. With more than 500,000 members, we are the nation's largest conservative research and education institution. We believe the principles and ideas of the American founding are worth conserving and renewing. Please help us further our mission by subscribing to this channel and sharing our videos with your family and friends.
President Biden signed the nearly $2 trillion spending package this week without a single Republican vote. And another week has gone by without the president taking any questions from reporters. This as the nation marks that one-year anniversary of the pandemic lockdowns. To discuss, let's bring in our political panel for the week. Newsmax contributor and Democrat strategist Doug Schoen and senior advisor and spokesperson for the Heritage Foundation, Genevieve Wood. All right, Doug, another $2 trillion in debt, no Republican support. How's that pledge to bring bipartisanship working out?
Well, I don't think it's working out as well as we would have wanted or hoped. And I'm one of those Democrats, and Tom, I've done it here and said it to Genevieve, that wishes that there had been a greater effort by the Democrats to do this bill on a bipartisan basis. That being said, there didn't appear to be much appetite among the Republicans for another stimulus, notwithstanding the size and scope of the last one that President Trump advocated for last year. But I hope that we do get bipartisanship on infrastructure, on other issues going forward. I think the country requires it. And I think one of the legacies, hopefully, of the pandemic will be that we have a renewed sense of national purpose and national goals. And I'm, for one, hoping that that is a result of us getting to this point.
But most of that stimulus money from the last stimulus bill hasn't even been spent yet. Doug, another week has gone by. The president is spending trillions of dollars we don't have, and he refuses to take questions from reporters. He literally turns around and walks away. Isn't it time we heard the president answer some questions about this agenda, which seems to be much further to the left than the country is? And don't the American people deserve to hear from their president without a teleprompter, Doug?
Well, that's a simple one, Tom. I'd say yes to that. But I would also say that there's a lot in this bill that obviously goes beyond COVID, the child care relief initiative, which is very close to what Mitt Romney himself has proposed, and I think Mike Lee. So I would like to see the president take questions and talk about the bill beyond the primetime address and do that in a forum where he gets to answer questions. So, yes, absolutely.
Genevieve, look, I happen to think that the GOP has done a terrible job of articulating to the American people what's in this bill, just how damaging it is. I'd like to address two aspects with you. First, rewarding failure with these sort of blue state bailouts, $400 billion in there. And then also the provision that actually prevents states from cutting taxes, either directly or indirectly, if they're getting aid. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, Tom, you've outlined just two of the major problems with this bill. And as Doug said earlier, I'd love to see a national goal and priority as well. But mine would be to get our budget and our spending under control, because eventually you run out of the money here. And Look, as you just noted, and I think Tom noted, much of this bill has nothing to do with COVID. We've done stimulus before. We can see what works, what doesn't. We know that just handing out checks willy-nilly, both to individuals and to states and these pension funds that are way already in the red, we know that doesn't work, because what they do is they don't get their house in order. They just take the money for the government and keep doing what they've been doing. That's happened at the state level, at the local level, and it's got to stop. I mean, Doug talked about infrastructure. That's probably another $2 trillion piece of legislation coming down the pike. And when you add all of this up, it ends up meaning that every individual citizen in this country, regardless of age, if you're 2 years old or 80 years old, now owes $67,000 in debt. Yeah. That is simply just not sustainable.
Yeah.
And we're not going to have the money to do the things we need to do, like maybe dealing with infrastructure problems, paying Social Security, and some of these other promises that we've made to, for example, our senior citizens. We've got a lot of debt, and we've got a lot of unpaid promises. And eventually, those things are not going to line up.
Right.
So there's a bill. It is a new bill in one sense, because the old bill actually expired from the last Congress. But the bill is called the Violence Against Women Act, and it was just voted on in the U.S. House. So why did so many Republicans vote against it? I thought I'd get in touch with Sarah Perry, who is legal fellow at the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Sarah, welcome to the program. And I always warn my audience, many of the bills on Capitol Hill have really deceptive names, or they hide things that people would ordinarily object to. I swear the next time thing I'm going to hear is a piece of legislation called the Rainbows and Puppy Dogs Bill, because they always put a warm, fuzzy name on it. But oftentimes it conceals things that are the reason why you find out that some representatives would vote against it. Welcome back, by the way. And what is the reason?
Thank you. Well, there are a couple of different reasons, actually, Lars. And there are 29 Republicans who voted. They broke ranks. They voted against the Violence Against Women Act. They were pilloried on social media, as you can imagine. Some people on Twitter calling them trash for voting against a bill that would protect women from violence. And, of course, it's got a very sort of anodyne-sounding name along the lines of the Equal Rights Amendment or the Equality Act. But there are a couple of problematic provisions. Chief among them is the fact that there are significant concerns regarding gender identity being swept up within the notion of sex as defined in the Violence Against Women Act. What this would do practically is put biological men in the bathrooms, showers, and beds next to biological women at domestic abuse shelters, the very places that these women and children are going to avoid any kind of risk that increases their susceptibility to abuse. And what you've done is you've essentially made these facilities co-ed, a major, major problem. It also prevents gun purchases, expands anti-gun laws in incidents that not only has a court deemed to be a criminal act, but now the federal legislature has deemed unilaterally to be violative of your right to own a gun. So it violates single-handedly Second Amendment rights for gun owners. It's also got a number of jurisdictional problems. There are people and among our MEAS Center at the Heritage Foundation who have explored extensively its problems under Article 2 and Article 3 of the Constitution, essentially expanding jurisdiction for Indian tribal lands over non-Indians. Well, as you know, Lars, tribal lands, tribes are sovereign nations under American law. So this is a major problem. It expands jurisdiction over people who are not themselves Native American because they happen to be on Native American land. That was a tack on right at the end. So we have multiple issues with this legislation, and it sounds very useful and very helpful and very important, but it is really, as is typical of this Congress, a poison pill for a lot of left-wing perspectives.
Well, like I said, Sarah, it's the rainbows and puppy dogs bill, and you say, who could be against that? But let me ask you something specifically. When people hear about the gun purchase restrictions, there are anti-gun people out there. I'm not one of them. I own guns. I carry a gun. But when I hear it, when the anti-gunners hear it, they say, well, that'll keep all those bad men who are, you know, doing violence against women from getting a gun. No, what it also does is the young lady who just broke up, ugly breakup with a boyfriend or a girlfriend or a husband, and is now fearful. She's fearing for her life because this person is acting in an outrageous manner, and she's afraid, and this happens to too many women, that he's going to show up on her front porch at 2 a.m, and she may call the cops, but they're 5 or 10 minutes away, and so she says, I'll go get a gun. And then you can't go get one because your rights are limited. Do they sense the irony in having a bill that calls itself the Violence Against Women Act, and then it says, oh, but by the way, some of you young ladies, if you have a quick need for a firearm, you won't be able to get it, which means you may be dead. Just to put it bluntly, you may be dead because of the Violence Against Women Act.
Absolutely. And in fact, the rationale for this particular provision on guns, it was closing what they called the boyfriend loophole, was the fact that women in increasing numbers are seeking more and more gun possessions, right?
God bless
them. So they're acquiring them legally. You got it. And I have to tell you, they've attributed that to a rise in domestic violence. They have not attributed to other concerns. And I am one of those particular individuals, someone who sees the constitutional horizon for the Second Amendment starting to darken. So women are getting guns in increasing numbers, not only because of domestic violence, but for other reasons that both sexes are achieving newer and more increasing levels of gun ownership. So it really, it's a double-edged sword in this attempt to limit gun access by these violent individuals. You're also limiting it to people who want to get guns, who are biological females who want to have it to protect themselves.
Absolutely. Hey, I want one clarification. We'd said 3/4. The vote was 244 to 172, 29 Republicans joining the Democrats. What explanation do we have for that, other than that those 29 are the usual rhinos who like to side with the Democrats or they're from problematic political districts? Do they give a reason for why they would favor something like this that so clearly shouldn't pass in its current form?
Well, it's interesting you should bring that up, Lars, because we have just a few who are sort of, you know, reliably on the fence about certain things. But I will tell you, the NRA, the gun lobby, has been very significantly vocal about this particular bill. I think that changed a lot. As you know, lobbying is a very effective tool. And the individuals who voted with the Democrats in this regard, I think, were probably from particular districts, and this is based on what I know of just the composition of those individuals, from areas in which the NRA does not have as particularly strong a presence necessarily. And they decided that, of course, you know, many of these bills, Lars, are so long. And the Equal Rights Amendment, for example, is a perfect example of this. Hearings also held in the House on the same day while Senate hearings were taking place on the Equality Act. So this is a trifecta of bad bills that sound very good. A lot of them had concerns that they were not going to be reelected. We have midterms, obviously, coming up in 2022. A lot of us have predicted sort of a bellwether change because those individuals who relied originally on promises of moderation and unity are sort of finding themselves faced with a rude awakening. And so I think a lot of them at this point are trying to save their political seats. It's happened before. Would not surprise me if it happened this time as well.
Sarah Perry is a legal fellow at the Mies Center. And Sarah, I keep expecting unity, too, from the people who call us Neanderthals and things like that. They've given us so many reasons to believe in that. Sarah, keep up the good work at the Mies Center and also at Heritage. Thanks so much for the time tonight.
Good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining us to discuss this critical topic of U.S. nuclear modernization. My name is Patty Jane Geller, and I'm the policy analyst for nuclear deterrence and missile defense here at the Heritage Foundation. I'm joined today by Senator Deb Fischer, who we have here on screen. Senator Fischer represents the state of Nebraska, home to Offutt Air Force Base and the headquarters of U.S. Strategic Command. She's the ranking member of the Senate Armed Services Subcommittee on Strategic Forces. We're thrilled that she's able to take time out of her busy schedule to give us her insights on where the U.S. is going with nuclear modernization. So we're going to start off today's event with some comments from Senator Fischer on the political backdrop for nuclear modernization, and then I'll move on to some questions. So Senator, whenever you're ready, please start us off.
Okay, well, thank you for that introduction, Patty Jane, and to Heritage for hosting this event to discuss the future of nuclear modernization. The merits for modernization are very compelling. Systems age, their effectiveness declines, and ultimately they will reach a point where they need to be replaced. The vast majority of our nuclear systems date to the height of the Cold War. And the way that we've been able to sustain them, it's been pretty remarkable. We've had three generations of a single family that have flown the B-52s, a platform that will be almost 100 years old by the time it retires. We're going to get over 40 years of service life out of our Ohio-class submarines, and that's longer than we ever have operated a submarine before. The same is true for the Department of Energy facilities that sustain our warheads. This work is carried out across an infrastructure complex, half of which is over 40 years old. Over 30% dates to the Manhattan Project and the early Cold War era. And since production ceased at Rocky Flats facility in 1989, we have not had the industrial capability to produce plutonium pits, which are often referred to as the core of a nuclear weapon. We've relied on legacy pits and an impressive suite of scientific capabilities to establish confidence in our nuclear weapons' continued effectiveness. These accomplishments, they are a testament to the ingenuity of our workforce, but at the same time, they reflect the urgent need for recapitalizing the bedrock of our national security. Life extensions only go so far. Nothing lasts forever. Ultimately, these systems will age out, and replacements must be ready before this happens, or we'll have a gap in our deterrent capabilities. At the rate it takes to design, develop, and field systems of this level of complexity, and again, we're talking about nuclear weapons, that work must be done now. I think most members of Congress understand these basic principles. Of course, there's a debate about how exactly we go about modernizing. We've had that debate in one form or another every year that I've been a member of the Senate, and I expect that that will continue to be the case. Now, the Biden administration's views on these issues aren't clear. And we're seeing a renewed push from outside groups to abandon some of the foundational elements of the modernization effort. So I expect this year's debate will be particularly significant. In advance of that, I think there are two key things that we need to keep in mind. First, the modernization schedule has no room for delay. As I mentioned, these are nuclear systems. They take a long time to develop. And previous decisions to delay and defer modernization have taken all the slack out of the schedule. We are now facing the very real prospect of systems aging out before replacements are available. Admiral Richard, the STRATCOM commander, has testified that many of the modernization and sustainment efforts we're carrying out, quote, have zero schedule margin and are late to need, end quote. That means we do not have the luxury of putting things on hold while various policy reviews are conducted. I know some opponents of these programs are calling for the administration to do exactly that. And I think to some people, that might seem sensible. Why shouldn't the new administration just freeze things where they stand, take a year to study things, and only proceed after it's done its own analytic work to validate these programs? That seems innocent, but it is not. Again, because of the past decisions to delay these programs, hitting pause now, it would break the modernization schedule and result in systems aging out before their replacements are delivered. Proponents of a pause suggest it would allow for further consideration of modernization choices, but really, it would effectively make those choices for us. And that's why it's so important for us to keep this timeline in mind. The other factor we cannot lose sight of is the changing threat landscape. I know others have made this point, but it's worth repeating because it bears out how sharply the geopolitical situation has worsened over the last 10 years. The 2010 Nuclear Posture Review stated, quote, Russia is not an enemy and is increasingly a partner in confronting proliferation and other emerging threats, end quote. No serious person would say such a thing today. And since then, both Russia and China have invested heavily in their nuclear forces. Russia is developing entirely new nuclear capabilities and arming dozens of dual-capable weapon systems, ranging from short-range ballistic missiles to torpedoes to landmines. Meanwhile, Admiral Richard recently stated that China is likely to double, if not triple, its nuclear stockpile. And they are on its way to becoming a peer nuclear competitor by the end of the decade. This has implications for our deterrence requirements and policy implications as well. In particular, it's notable that this investment has happened while the U.S. exercised a restrained approach to its nuclear posture. I think the best summary of the lesson we can learn from this comes from President Obama's Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, in 2016 when he was visiting Offutt Air Force Base in my home state of Nebraska. When discussing nuclear modernization, he said, quote, over the last 25 years, we made only modest investments in basic sustainment and operations. But while we didn't build anything new for 25 years, and neither did our allies, others did, including Russia, North Korea, China, Pakistan, India, and for a period of time, Iran. So we can't wait any longer, and we also can't operate under the mistaken assumption that our own recapitalization will stimulate others to invest, because the evidence is just the opposite. They have consistently invested in nuclear weapons during a quarter century pause in U.S. investment, end quote. I think that's a very valuable observation and something we must consider, particularly as we hear calls to reduce our forces or cancel modernization programs. So why don't I stop there, Patty Jane, and we can move on to questions.
Excellent, that's great. Thanks so much, Senator. So I'll jump right into my first question. As you know, President Biden recently released his interim national security strategic guidance. It stated that we will take steps to reduce the role of nuclear weapons in our national security strategy while ensuring our strategic deterrent remains safe, secure, and effective. What's your reaction to this?
You know, what struck me is the way that this repeats past rhetoric. The passage is almost exactly what President Obama said in his statement in the 2010 Nuclear Posture Review. And I see a couple problems with this. First, the world's changed a lot since 2010. In fact, it's become far more dangerous. So when we keep hearing the same talking points, I think that suggests maybe a lack of appreciation for the changes that we've seen. It also, I think, ignores some of the lessons that were made pretty clear by the end of the Obama administration. As Secretary Carter was pointing out in the quotation that I just read, while the US was reducing its arsenal and the role of nuclear weapons, Russia and China, they were going in the opposite direction. But as you said in your question, this is interim guidance. So I hope going forward, we will see a strategy that is based on a clear-eyed view of the threats that our nation faces, and it takes into account what we've seen from this approach in the past. One of the many things that Secretary Mattis said that is so quotable is we need to see the world as it is and not as we wish it to be.
Yeah, excellent. I think that's very important. So there's discussion about whether the Biden administration will conduct a new nuclear posture review. Do you think that this would be wise?
I do. I think particularly if the administration is considering changes to our nuclear posture, but also because, as we all know, threats continue to evolve. And that's part of the old question about whether strategy should drive budgets or budget should drive strategy. I think it's important to have policy reviews happen and strategies decided before changes are made instead of the other way around. The NPR is an important way for the administration to be able to think through its approach, to bring in civilian officials, military leaders to produce that strategy, and then have transparency in conveying that to Congress and the American people. So I think it's also important that our allies have an opportunity to speak to what the strategy is as well. We've seen the last several administrations do this, and I think it's been helpful. I don't think using the budget process to make decisions about our nuclear posture is appropriate, especially in an abbreviated budget cycle. But let me be clear. We shouldn't be conducting an NPR to pause nuclear modernization. That should not happen. Modernization already is just in time, if not late, in need. And so we don't have the luxury of pausing or delaying these important programs.
Yeah, excellent. You mentioned in your answer working with our allies and partners. So I want to ask more about that. The Biden administration has been emphasizing the importance of our allies and partners and talking a lot about expanding their role in U.S. foreign policy. How do you see this playing out in nuclear policy?
Well, I think that's a good sign. I think it should mean that a greater focus on our deterrence commitments are often overlooked, and our NATO allies and our allies in Asia all depend upon that U.S. nuclear umbrella. They should look at the approach that we have to modernization as a reflection of how seriously we take that responsibility. A lot of times we forget about the commitments we have to our allies when it comes to nuclear deterrence. We don't express that enough. And I think it would only be positive for us to be able to do that. You know, a lot of times we hear people say that China can meet its deterrence requirements with only a few hundred weapons, so why can't the U.S.? Well, you have to look at the fact that we are supportive of over 30 other nations who depend on our nuclear forces for their protection, and China doesn't offer any of those guarantees. There was a recent article in Foreign Affairs by former Secretary Chuck Hagel and others about this subject with our allies, and I think they really underline the importance of ensuring that our extended deterrent commitments remain credible. And that's something that these nations depend upon, that our deterrent has the technical skills to develop nuclear weapons on their own, even those nations. We want to be sure that this deterrent serves our goals for nonproliferation. And I think it's very important that we don't cast any doubt on that to those who are dependent upon it.
Yeah, I'm glad you bring that up. And as another issue, outside groups are also calling for Biden to declare a no first use policy, meaning that the United States pledges not to use nuclear weapons first in a conflict. How do you think our allies would react to this?
Well, I think we should all remember and take note that a no first use policy, it's been rejected by every president, including President Obama. Three members of the president's cabinet, Secretary Carter, Secretary Kerry, Secretary Moniz, they reportedly opposed that as well in 2016. This is something that our allies, I think, are very apprehensive about. And the advice that we hear consistently from our senior military leaders has been not to adopt such a policy. A couple years ago, Congress required an independent study of this, and that was published in January by the Institute for Defense Analysis. And I would recommend that to the audience. It really looks at this question in detail. And it concluded that this would do more harm than good. So if the administration is considering changes to our declaratory policy, I really hope they take a look at this study and they engage with our allies. There's a very compelling case there. There's bipartisan support in Congress for maintaining our current approach, and the administration, I would hope, would take note of that and be supportive of it.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. One more question on this topic of allies. I want to quickly bring up the United Kingdom. Its recently released security review announced that the UK's nuclear stockpile ceiling would be increased to 260 nuclear weapons. It had previously been in the process of being reduced from 225 to, I think, 180. And as a result, it's being accused of starting an arms race. What do you think about this?
Well, the United Kingdom is a very strong ally of ours. And their independent nuclear deterrent is a very critical element of NATO's security. And it contributes to our security as well. I read a report saying that we made a decision in 2010 to reduce our arsenal, and the world has changed, threats have grown, and that decision's no longer appropriate. And I don't disagree with that. So I'm surprised by, I guess, the amount of criticism we've seen over the week. It's more criticism of our strong ally than I've seen of Russia or China for their nuclear buildups. Those are far more significant than what the United Kingdom has announced. So where, I would just question, where's the outrage when President Putin announced a bunch of new nuclear weapons in 2018? And then we, you know, we're seeing Russia and China jump on the bandwagon here and also criticize the UK. But I'm glad you brought up the way arms race is being used in this as well. I think that's very reckless. When we look, we all know that the threats change. Governments have a primary responsibility of protecting their citizens. So I think it's reasonable to debate the wisdom of their actions, but to say everything's an arms race, I think is unserious. And it's being applied selectively to certain countries, but not to others that I would say are participating in an arms race.
Yeah, I think that's extremely well said, Senator. I also hear a lot of accusations that the U.S. is starting an arms race, even as it moves forward with our modernization programs like the LRSO, the replacement for our air-launched cruise missile. And like you said, it doesn't seem to make sense given what Russia and China are doing. So anyway, I'm going to switch gears now to the topic of affordability. Critics often complain that the price tag of nuclear modernization, especially as a flat budget top line, becomes likelier. What do you think, Senator? Is modernization affordable within a budget-constrained environment?
Yes. We have to remember that nuclear weapons are still less than 7% of the DoD's budget. And only about half of that is even connected to modernization, and the rest goes to maintaining our current force. Nuclear deterrence is the number one mission of the Department of Defense. We have had the past four secretaries of defense say that, and Secretary Austin has agreed with that. And that means when you're putting together a budget, it's the first thing. It's the first thing that goes in. I think many times we see this discussed in the opposite way, and to me that's backwards, where funding for everything else is assumed necessary, and at the end of the day, the only choice we have is either to raise the defense top-line spending or we cut nuclear weapons. Or sometimes you hear about how we have to cut nuclear weapons in order to fund increases in other capabilities like in cyber or AI. But what both of these arguments are essentially saying is we need to cut our top priority in order to fund everything, fund other things that are out there. That's exactly the opposite of what it means to prioritize. If you prioritize something, that's the first thing you fund. Nuclear modernization is not cheap, but it's necessary. And another Secretary Mattis saying is that America can afford survival.
Yeah, and you also hear some argue that these capabilities you mentioned, particularly cyber, can be substituted for nuclear weapons. And that idea is used to justify redirecting funding to those areas. Can you comment on that?
Well, you know, cyber capabilities, they're important. And prior to chairing the Strategic Forces Subcommittee, I chaired the Emerging Threats and Capabilities Subcommittee on the Senate Armed Services Committee. And at that time, we had the responsibility for overseeing the department on their cyber activities. But I think that this idea of substituting one for the other it's not wise. I recall a conversation that I had on this in a hearing with General Dunford when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and his testimony I thought was very, very clear. He said cyber capabilities cannot be substituted for nuclear capabilities. They're fundamentally different. It's a shame that he couldn't elaborate at that hearing, but obviously discussing what we can't and can't do through cyber and comparing that to our nuclear capabilities isn't possible in an unclassified environment. But I think that statement, people should keep that in mind.
Mm. Yeah, that does make it challenging to assess these proposals, but I do see how it would be difficult for cyber capabilities to achieve the same deterrent effects as nuclear weapons, like you were saying. So going right back to the budget, what about non-DoD spending? Last year, the president requested and Congress provided a significant increase in funding for the National Nuclear Security Administration, the NNSA. Why do you think that the NNSA needed such a big increase?
You know, they're facing the same challenges that the Department of Defense faces. You have a nuclear complex that's old. And since the end of the Cold War, we have delayed and deferred modernizing it. At the same time, it's being asked to do more, not just extending the lives of our warheads, but also all the scientific work that comes with certifying our increasingly aging arsenal to make sure it's effective. I think one other thing to keep in mind is that the budgets that are submitted on behalf of the NNSA, they've struggled, I think, to reflect what's needed for modernization. They, when you look at the projections for future spending, that's included with each budget submission, they've left out a lot of activities. Consider, for example, pit production. That's a requirement for the NNSA to produce those plutonium pits, and it's been there a long time. It's part of the modernization commitment that President Obama made in connection with the New START Treaty in 2010, this isn't new, and we knew that the NNSA was going to need to do it, and we also knew it was going to be expensive. But at the end of the Obama administration and then the early part of the Trump administration, NNSA was still developing its plan for how they were going to meet this requirement. So they really didn't have a plan, so they couldn't predict costs with it. So the budget didn't include any kind of spending for that pit production. And that was something I discussed with General Klotz, the administrator at the time. And he was very forthright about it. He was candid about it. They finally finalized their strategy, and then the costs were included. And I think that is one point you can look at for the increasing budget.
Yeah, that's really useful to know. So basically what you're saying is that sometimes these increases aren't all that they seem to be.
No, they're not at all. We shouldn't act like it's no big deal. I mean, this is very expensive, and NSA is being asked to do a lot more. They're going to need budget increases in order to meet those requirements, but that's something that has to be done. You know, it costs less to study pit production than it does to rebuild the capabilities that we're going to need.
Right, makes sense. So just quickly staying on this issue of pit production, I think you also mentioned in your opening remarks that the U.S. is the only nuclear state that does not have the capability to produce plutonium pits. Why is that significant?
Well, it's very significant. All of our warheads entered the stockpile that during the Cold War. And we replaced certain components of that through the life extension programs. But we still are relying on these legacy pits, and plutonium breaks down over time. So the process is slow, but there will come a time when our weapons, well, they're just not going to work the way they should. And as I did say in my opening remarks, we need to act now to prevent that from happening. That means we have to stand up production capability that we haven't had in 30 years and producing enough pits to replace those that are in the stockpile before we begin really to lose confidence in their effectiveness. And that's the technical argument. But when I talk about this with people, with constituents, what I think really hits home with people is that North Korea is capable of manufacturing nuclear weapons, but the United States actually can't. And I know that some will say, you know, you shouldn't be making that comparison. You're just trying to alarm people. But I disagree with that. I think we've become very, very complacent in this country, and I believe we have to bring a greater sense of urgency to this problem that we have. If the United States is serious about remaining a nuclear power, we have to have pit production capability, because nothing lasts forever.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear you talk about confidence in our arsenal, in our nuclear weapons arsenal. I think that's something that's probably not discussed enough. I see we're running up on the clock here, but Senator, if you have a few more minutes, I want to get to asking you about the ground-based strategic deterrent quickly.
Sure.
We're seeing renewed opposition from critics of nuclear modernization focused on GBSD, the program to replace our 50-year-old Minuteman III ICBMs. What's your assessment of the debate over this program?
Well, there's been a very active debate over this program, and I appreciate the effort that Heritage and others have made to try and correct a lot of the misconceptions that are out there. When I hear people use terminology like hair trigger, for example, I support the GBSD program. I think everybody knows that. We have heard consistent testimony across the last two administrations that this program is absolutely necessary. We've been discussing this program annually at our oversight hearings on SASC. And based on the arguments that have been presented, majorities in Congress have supported it. We've provided about $2 billion since 2015 for this program. I am not aware of any change in the threat that we face or the reliability of the current Minuteman system that would justify either delaying or completely halting the GBSD. And I know a lot of opponents have gathered around this idea of canceling GBSD and extending the life of the Minuteman system. When we look at Admiral Richards' comments earlier this year about how it's just not feasible to do that, I think we can really look at this with in a more realistic way. I think there's there's very little I can add to what he said, and we don't have time to talk through all of the arguments on the topic, but I'll make one observation. When the Air Force studied extending the Minuteman, it found that this would actually be more expensive in the long run than building a new missile. And I know those who support this approach will argue that it's cheaper in the near term, but deferring costs isn't the same as saving money. In 2012, the decision to delay the Columbia-class submarine by 2 years, it pushed activities beyond the five-year budget window, and that created an appearance of saving money. But the Navy estimated that this actually increased the total program cost by billions of dollars, and it left the program with no margin for further delay or error in the development schedule. So I think those are fool strategies, and that's why we have to make sure that modernization continues.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that's a great point. And you mentioned Admiral Richard's comments on this, which I thought were really compelling. I think he said that some of the drawings for the Minuteman III are so old that those who can understand them aren't even alive anymore.
Yeah, you know, I've had the opportunity to be in the Senate and have met and worked with four of the combatant commanders at STRATCOM, from General Kaler, Admiral Haney, General Hyten, and now Admiral Richard. And I believe each one of those individuals was the right person for that position at just the right time, that we needed them there. And I believe that is especially true of Admiral Richard. I have such admiration for him and respect. He puts the facts out there for people. He lays it out. He's pretty straight about it. And he is the person we need there, and we should be listening to him.
Yeah, good point. I totally agree with that. Admiral Richard has been great. Well, Senator, I feel like there's a lot more we to discuss, especially on this GBSD topic, but it looks like we're over time here. So I feel like that's probably a good note to close off on. So we want to be respectful of your time. I know you have a busy schedule. So I wanted to thank you again for joining us in this event and taking the time. It's been a really great discussion.
Well, thank you, Patty Jane. This has been very good. I hope the audience it stimulated some thinking and conversation, and we can move ahead with an important program here for our country.
Excellent. I think so too. Thank you.
Thank you.